Hello, and welcome to Thank the Academy, the podcast where we talk about every Academy Award-winning Best Picture in order. This is the Academy Archives, and this week we're discussing films of 1980 and Academy Award winner Thelma Schoonmaker. We're your hosts, Zach and Kristen, and that's our producer, Kayla.
Howdy.
Hello.
Hello.
We're here.
Mm-hmm.
Back again.
Yeah.
We're talking about some other films in 1980.
Yeah, so we have just accomplished the 53rd Academy Awards.
Mm-hmm. Ordinary People.
Yes, Ordinary People, which is a phenomenal film if you've not seen it.
We definitely
go
watch
on
that.
And on and wax poetic about it.
Mm-hmm. It'll be a little bit different this episode because...
Why, Zach?
Well, I've just been very busy and we have a lot of things going on in life. Nothing out of the ordinary. So today, mostly just Kristen will be bringing us a segment.
Kristen did her homework. Kristen always does her homework, though.
I did get to watch some other films from 1980, and they're quite good. And I'll just give a little brief talk about them both, and then we'll hear about Thelma Schoonmaker.
Yes.
But first, of course, we definitely have a Bosley review.
All right. Bosley, what have you been watching?
Well, Bosley watched a movie from 1980.
Oh, good. Oh, we should clarify that Bosley is our dog.
Yes, Bosley is our dog. He's some sort of poodle terrier mix, and he, like us, loves movies.
He does, and he has a lot of thoughts, but because he is a canine, he likes to give us reviews of other animal performances.
Yes. So Bosley is reviewing the performance of Benjean.
Okay.
Daughter of Higgins, the original Benji.
Oh, wow.
And Benjean is now carrying on the family legacy.
Aw, Benjean.
Of playing Benji.
That's so cute.
So this movie is a movie that is sort of in the Benji series. It is called...
It's in the Benji cinematic universe.
Yes. Oh, Heavenly Dog.
Oh.
And Benjean gets to play Benji, who is the reincarnation of Chevy Chase.
What?
After he dies.
Oh, my.
To help solve his own murder.
Oh, my. Wow, she's a detective.
Yeah. But, you know, it's classic Benji stuff.
Antics.
Yes.
And shenanigans.
She looks very, very similar. She actually, I'll have to say... Looks oh. more like what I picture of Benji than the original Benji.
Interesting.
I don't know. She just looks more like classic Benji for some reason.
Huh.
She played Benji actually more times than her dad played Benji.
Wow. Man, she's making her own legacy.
Yeah. And not only did she star in Oh Heavenly Dog this year, she also starred in Benji at Work. Which was a 30-minute documentary film that premiered on ABC in 1980, all about her working as Benji.
Wow! she got a documentary, like an actors on actors kind of thing.
Yeah.
I love that.
I was trying to find clips from the actual documentary, but I couldn't find it. But I found a couple of interviews, because I guess 1980 was just a big year for her. As a dog actor. And she is so funny. And I watched a couple clips from Oh Heavenly Dog with Bosley, of course. He watched the whole film.
Yeah.
But I just wanted to catch up on some clips. I mean, she does exactly everything Benji would do. But in one of the... it's like a TV segment talking all about her, and her trainer is there. And she is just so quick on doing all the tricks. He's just like constantly moving his hands and doing all kinds of stuff. And she's just like laser focused and just going through so many things.
Wow.
Yawning, sneezing, up and down. She knew how to roll herself over by grabbing one of her paws with her mouth. And like she was pulling herself over and rolled over that way. Very cute. She could jump up and down and do like a bow with one paw up.
Aww,
as if it was hurt.
Cute.
It was pretty amazing.
Yeah.
Bosley was very impressed.
He should be. That is quite the performer, an actor through and through.
He was thinking that she, as a dog, has so many skills.
Yeah. Wow.
A lot of skills that he might like to learn.
Oh, Bosley, you should. Yeah. Branch out.
But of course, he was also so impressed that she's carrying on the family legacy.
Yeah, that's great.
He thinks that that would be so fun.
Aww.
In his tradition of reviewing Benji, Bosley gives Benjine, daughter of the original Benji Higgins, two big sniffs and a howl.
All right. It's a mark of approval.
Yeah.
Very nice. Benjine.
And she got to play as Chevy Chase.
Oh, boy. Wow.
As a dog.
Poor thing.
So with that, I'm just going to mention some things about some important films.
Because you started working on the episode.
Both of these other films that I just want to highlight are Raging Bull and The Elephant Man. Two films from the decade, the 80s, that in general are considered two of the best films of the 80s.
And two of the most prolific directors of this time.
Yeah. So very fun. Raging Bull was not a financial success at all. It ended up costing $18 million and only grossed $23 million, which is like really crazy for how well known of a film it is.
Yeah.
Scorsese, through most of the making of this film, was assuming that it was going to be the last film he ever made.
Oh, wow.
So he was very, very intentional about like everything regarding the film. He was also like doing the film coming out of really intense drug use. And Robert De Niro was trying to like help him recover from that and using this film and their friendship to kind of bring him back to reality. So it's a really interesting story. It's a very well-known story that they made this film. That Scorsese hates boxing and sports in general. He thinks sports are like one of the dumbest things known to man. But of course, the film is based on real life boxer Jake LaMotta. The whole story is based on his autobiography, and they made the movie. It was a huge thing for Robert De Niro. During the middle of filming, he gained 65 pounds so that he could play him like. Later, having gained weight.
Oh, like mid-movie.
Yeah.
Wow.
They took a four-month break in the middle of the movie.
They said, eat.
And he went to Italy for 4 months and just binge-eat. Like,
oh, my.
To gain 60 pounds, basically. Very unhealthy. And it really, like, almost killed him in a way.
I was going to say, that, and even if it doesn't hurt you in the moment, that screws your metabolism.
Well, and it really screwed up, like, his bone structure, his voice, it like really changed a lot of things so that he was forced to like try to lose the weight pretty significantly when he finished so that he could remain like a living, healthy person.
Right. Well, your body probably thinks that something is wrong if you're doing that so intentionally so fast.
Yeah. So very unhealthy. I think some actors nowadays, they do it with like trainers and with other like nutritionists and stuff involved. It's still a pretty unhealthy habit for a lot of people to do.
It's still a very unhealthy habit.
But it was just this thing that he was very praised for because it was like not something that had really ever been done before in such a public sphere and by such a public actor.
Gotcha. Yeah, that is not the thing anymore. We're not gaining weight or losing tons of weight to play people.
Yeah.
That's what makeup artists are for. Or other actors are for.
Yes. And, of course, that is a big thing from the year 1980.
Also from 2023.
Yeah.
Or 22.
But the film has since, I mean, it was a big critical success.
Right. Yeah.
It was nominated for several awards. Robert De Niro won his award. Martin Scorsese lost Best Director, which he will do many, 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 many times.
The beginning
until
of a grand tradition.
Several decades from 1980 when he finally wins. But yeah, I don't personally like this movie, but I can see why it's a good movie.
Sure. That's fair.
And it's definitely worth talking about because of Thelma Schoonmaker.
Yeah, yeah.
And
well,
so
and she
you'll
wins
get into
her,
some of that.
Yeah, mm-hmm, yeah.
So then moving on to The Elephant Man, of course, I can't not mention this film as well. Another really amazing film. Funny enough, both of these films were shot in black and white this year in 1980.
Interesting.
Which is very cool and fun to watch two black and white movies from this era.
It's funny because I've always thought growing up that The Elephant Man was a really old movie because it's black and white.
Well, and both of them feel so much older than they actually are because of that.
Yeah.
They just feel very, very classic.
Yeah. Well, The Elephant Man is cool because it is back in time. So to me, it feels like people in the 30s when they were making movies about the 1800s.
Right.
You know.
Well, and it felt very akin to like watching The Last Picture Show.
Sure, yeah.
Watching both of these movies, where it's like two directors, like Peter Bogdanovich, who directed The Last Picture Show, all three of them are very like art house kind of independent filmmakers at this point. They're not really tied to studios. They really have their own voice in film, and they're doing something really interesting by deciding to shoot it in black and white.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Of course, this movie is very, very amazing. Tells the true life story of Joseph Merrick.
This is one of the few movies that we've come across that I had actually seen.
Yeah. he's actually called John Merrick in the film.
Right.
But his real life name was Joseph Merrick.
Okay.
He lived in 19th century London and was very severely deformed from when he was born. His like true life story is very remarkable. Hmm. And the film does take some liberties. The film makes it a lot more like Dickensian than the real life story.
Yeah, I definitely thought it was like of that.
Yeah, it adds a lot of characters that are very like stock Dickens characters.
Yeah.
Specifically, the guy who keeps coming back at night to like harass him is like not really a true part of the story. I mean, there were people who harassed him.
Sure.
But that was like a liberty taken with the story. You know, as a plot device.
Interesting.
In a very, like, we're inspired by Dickens and, like, the 1800s.
Setting things in the same place and
in
time.
London.
And,
yeah. One of the only American actors in the film was Anne Bancroft.
Oh, wow.
And she is amazing in the film. Of course,
you know
she plays...
I haven't seen it since I was a kid, so I don't even remember her in
it. She plays Madge Kendall, the actress.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, so she's amazing in this as the actress. The interesting thing is that the play was being produced at the exact same time separately.
Ah.
So this is not based on the play, and the play is not based on this film.
Oh, interesting.
And the producers of the play, who were producing the play in the UK on the West End, actually sued the film because they had started producing the play first, and it was already called The Elephant Man.
Yeah.
And so the film ended up having to pay a settlement to the play because they didn't want to change the name The Elephant Man.
Oh, wow.
Because that's what he was called
yeah.
when he was alive.
Right. Well, and it is a very provocative name.
Right.
Like, it sounds really good.
Yeah. What else are you going to call it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So they just decided to pay the suit and then
well,
also
good.
Be because called The Elephant Man.
Also, the play is very good, too.
Yeah, the play is good, and it's very different, too.
My mom and sister and I saw it a couple years ago, several years ago now, when Bradley Cooper did it with Patricia Clarkson.
Yeah, probably almost 10 years ago.
Oh, no, don't say that. Oh, I've got so old.
But, of course, this was directed by David Lynch, who is, finally coming onto the scene. This is only the second movie he ever directed after Eraserhead.
Okay, gotcha.
So David Lynch famously went to college and sort of got his artistic start in Philadelphia.
Heck yeah, he did.
Which is why he made Eraserman, which
is Philadelphia,
about
right in the streets where I was working before we moved out here. Like,
his story
the neighborhood.
Is really crazy. He lived in Philadelphia in that neighborhood
in Callow Hill.
Yeah. It wasn't called Callow Hill at the time. But he purchased a house there that was like a 12-room house that was very, very cheap because it was like the most crime-ridden neighborhood in the city at that time.
Yep.
And within like a week of moving into that place, he and his like brand new wife got robbed.
Oh, no.
And like within the first like 3 months of them moving into that place, they got robbed like 6 times. So...
That's Philadelphia, baby.
Philadelphia in the
mid-60s. Mid-60s, 70s.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But he actually, this film was produced by Mel Brooks.
Oh, wow.
Which I didn't realize. And his film company.
Oh, dang.
And he specifically did not have his name in the credits as a producer because he didn't want anyone to think that it was going to be a comedy.
That is very smart, because
but
I would have.
He was very drawn to the story and aww, really wanted to work with David Lynch also.
He's an artist.
He is. And his wife, Anne Bancroft, is in it.
Heck yeah, she is.
Yeah. So just like a funny, interesting thing that I saw about this that like I didn't know that that was.
That's cool.
That he did. Yeah. So Brooks Films, which is his like uh-huh, production company, that is in the opening credits.
Okay.
That
but
it's like.
You don't know what that right, is if you're a normal person.
Yeah. Yeah. So a big producer who's attached to it.
Cool.
And he was very, you know, loved the story and loved the movie too.
Yeah.
This film actually did significantly well also, a little more financially well, because it had a budget of only $5 million and it ended up grossing $26 million.
Dang. Nice.
Which at the time is still like both of these films grossing in the mid 20 millions is very low for the 80s.
Hmm.
But they're both, you know, they're very like art house style films.
Yeah.
Another thing to highlight about this movie is it's edited by Anne V. Coates.
Oh, nice.
Another big woman editor that we've talked about.
She was the inspiration for the Women in Editing podcast episode.
Yeah. But just wanted to give a shout out to her.
Yeah.
Big
nice
year for those two women in editing.
Heck yeah, it is.
And I'll just go through quickly what each of these films was nominated for, and then we can move on to Thelma Schoonmaker. So back to Raging Bull. Raging Bull was nominated for 8 awards at the Academy Awards. It was nominated for Best Picture, Best Director, Best Actor, Best Supporting Actor for Joe Pesci, Best Supporting Actress for Kathy Moriarty, Best Cinematography for Michael Chapman, Best Film Editing for Thelma Schoonmaker, and Best Sound. It ended up winning Best Actor for Robert De Niro and Best Film Editing.
Nice.
The Elephant Man was nominated for 8 Academy Awards, which tied Raging Bull, including Best Picture, Best Actor in a Leading Role for John Hurt, which is interesting that he, I mean, he's the title character playing the Elephant Man, John Merrick. But to be honest, I feel like he should have been nominated in supporting. Because Anthony Hopkins is really the character that you're following through
right,
the whole movie.
It's hard when you have a character though that is like the
right,
you know,
he's the title character.
Yeah, he's the title character, and he's the one that everyone's revolving around.
Right. The tricky thing is, for the political reasons, he's not going to win as lead actor.
Yeah.
Against Robert De Niro.
Right.
But whatever. Also nominated for Best Art Direction, Best Costume Design, Best Director, Best Film Editing, Best Original Score, and Best Writing Screenplay based on material from another medium. But it did not win any awards.
Sad.
Unfortunately. The one that it should have won, of course, is makeup.
Yeah.
So the makeup artist was Christopher Tucker for this movie. And he was given access to actual casts that like a museum or somebody had of Joseph Merrick's actual body.
Wow.
And then he was able to make all of his prosthetics based on those casts.
My word.
So they were exactly as his body was in real life, which is pretty remarkable.
Yeah,
that
also
he was like,
sad, but
yeah, it's
like
very
humiliating.
Yeah, but it meant that they were able to tell his story
very
truthfully and accurately.
Wow, that's incredible. It's also just incredible that an artist can like do all those things. You know?
Yeah, and he really like took makeup and prosthetics to a new ground with this film as well, which of course is why the Academy decided the next year to recognize
makeup and hairstyling
as an official award.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Chris.
Yes. And so with that, those are the films of 1980 that you should seek out and see. And I will toss it over to you, Kristen, to hear about Thelma Schoonmaker.
Yeah. So today I'm talking about her. you know, I, for these episodes, I love talking about actresses mostly. I feel like that's my main interest as someone who is, you know,
an actress.
And actress too, but mostly actresses. But I really like to highlight the achievements of women mm-hmm. in the industry when I can. And, you know, there haven't been a ton that have come up. So one of the areas that women have been able to make a lot of get a lot of footholds in is film editing. Mm-hmm. And I have a whole episode I've already done in Academy Archives about women in the editing field. But we would be remiss mm-hmm. to do this podcast and not talk about Thelma Schoonmaker because of her immense contributions. If you take any film history class, she is a big part of it.
Yeah.
And you don't have Martin Scorsese's career without her.
Right.
So it's time to talk about the woman behind the films.
Mm-hmm.
So just to kind of give like a little bit of an overview, she has done a lot of interviews, but she's a very private person. So like there are a couple of interviews that are very famous and they're mostly what I'm pulling from today. Mm. So you may have already heard these quotes. And if you have, it's, you know, inspiring anyways.
Yeah.
But lots of people have very good things to say about her. So I have a lot of stuff from people talking about her rather than her own words. So of course, just a little bit of an overview. She of course has been in a partnership with Martin Scorsese, editing his films since about 1980. There's a little bit of controversy because they met before that and she helped him on his film, Who's That Knocking at My Door, in 1967.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of where they met and how they started their partnership, but she isn't like officially credited in it. And so it's like a whole weird thing. So the like really official public partnership begins in 1980 with Raging Bull. She has received 8 Oscar nominations and she's won 3 times for Raging Bull, The Aviator, and The Departed.
Mm-hmm.
She is the second most nominated editor in Oscar history, but she does hold the record for the most wins.
Wow. Good for her.
Yeah. And she has 29 counting, because I mean, she's still working every year it goes up. Other awards, including like BAFTAs and the Eddies, which are for editing and stuff like that. And of course, she is a role model and a trailblazer for so many younger women in mm-hmm. editing as well.
Well, and it's so amazing that she has been able, and I'm sure you're going to talk about this a little bit, but it's just like so amazing to me that somebody can have a career in editing that spans like old traditional editing to like new, like digital on the computer mm-hmm. editing.
Yeah, she
That's
began
crazy.
Cutting back in the 60s, you know? And now she's like able to keep up with everything. I love people like her and even Martin Scorsese who mm-hmm. are excited about the innovations in film and work to keep up with them and to utilize them. And like, you know, I mean, his films are a good example of that, of someone mm-hmm. who has evolved since 1980 to 2020 and is using the technologies and the innovations that come along with that.
Mm-hmm.
In 2012, the Motion Picture Editors Guild published a list of the 75 best edited films of all time based on a survey of the membership.
Mm-hmm.
3 films edited by her were on the list.
Wow.
Raging Bull, which was listed as first.
Right.
Like the most, the best.
Mm-hmm.
Goodfellas from 1990, which was 15th, and Hugo, which was 69th.
Oh. Wow.
Only George Tomasini, who was Alfred Hitchcock's editor, made more appearances on the list. He's the only person that beat her.
Huh.
I pulled this a couple of these quotes from like a lengthy IndieWire article about her, and I thought that they would also kind of help just like to shape perspective around what the importance of editing is.
Mm-hmm.
So this is from that magazine, quote, as Stanley Kubrick said, editing is the only unique aspect of filmmaking which does not resemble any other art form. And then they continue to say that ability to jump through time and space to show the viewer an image cut and connected to something entirely different to create new meaning, rhythm, and emotion is at the core of how a director guides the audience, which to me was just so interesting because I just hadn't thought about it in that context of how there aren't any other mediums that have this position that are doing this alongside of a director. The article goes on, quote, further complicating the ability to measure their contribution is how our favorite auteurs often rely on the same editors, forming professional marriages that span decades. Where does Steven Spielberg's visual efficiency end and Michael Caine's precision start?
Mm-hmm.
Could Spike Lee boldly shift tonal gears if Barry Alexander Brown wasn't there to preserve internal consistency? How much of Sofia Coppola's distinct pace and personality belongs to her script or to Sarah Flack's fine-tuning of the performances?
Mm. So. Yeah. Right. Well, and it's like, how do you achieve Martin Scorsese's signature feel and tone mm-hmm. and look of films without her?
Exactly.
Like, you can't.
And the article goes on to say that she is the pinnacle of all of these things.
Right.
This is a quote from Jennifer LaMey, who is a Noah Baumbach's editor for his last several films. She said, quote, "Thelma Schoonmaker is a North Star for so many editors, both inspiring and guiding with her amazing career. What I love so much about her is that although she is wildly talented and influential, she remains completely egoless." And this is also one of the things that has like stood out about her as I read all these different articles. Everyone is like, she is the most humble, nice lady. Like, so like willing to throw herself into the vision of the director and like trust her instincts, but not like overtake anything, which I think is really cool. From TCM, I was reading about like an article they wrote there. They said, quote, "Soft-spoken and decidedly low-key, Schoonmaker has been the polar opposite of her excitable and demonstrative counterpart, allowing for a symbiosis of equal footing in the editing room, two sides of the same coin that together produced some of the most iconic films in recent memory." Which also is cool, I think. I think it's really cool to see a partnership between two people who are so different in demeanor and also different in just like their personal expectations, but are able to align on the creative vision.
Yeah.
And the last like quote I wanted to share just to start us off comes from Joe Pesci, because he, of course, you know, worked with her a couple of times. He said, quote, "I've gotten killed in some films and it wasn't my fault. It pisses me off." And then they said he softened. Quote, "That stuff never happens with Thelma. I don't even have to think about it. She always chooses the best take."
Yeah.
Which I thought about a lot as I've, you know, thought about this episode. Like, how easy it is for someone to ruin your performance for you.
Yeah, right.
And like how scary it is as an actor to trust your editors. I mean, I feel this a lot where I'm really scared that the take that's going to get used is the take that is technically the best, but not mine. And I'll get into this and her perspective on some of this either, because she's an actor's editor,
truly,
at the end of the day. And thank goodness for it. She's the kind of inspiration we all need, because it's scary out there.
Well, and that's one thing about Scorsese films, too, for him as a director, is they're so much more focused on the actors than on anything else in the films.
Yeah, yeah. And I have some, like, interesting insights into that. So we'll get to it in just a little bit. But let's start at the beginning. She was born January 3rd, 1940 in Algiers. The Schoonmakers were evacuated to the U.S. shortly after the fall of France during the Second World War. In 1941, they moved to Aruba, where her father continued to work for Standard Oil. Her mother ran a nursery school, and she was primarily raised there. She had a little bit of her childhood in Portugal as well. But her family moved to the U.S. in 1955 when she was 15. She was really interested in a career in international diplomacy since she had lived all over the world. She began attending Cornell University in 1957, where she studied political science and Russian. She graduated in 1961, and right away she began to take the State Department test to apply for positions in the U.S. government, but she was met with opposition because, of course, it's the 60s, and so there were a lot of movements that were happening that she supported that kind of caused her to not do well on her tests and like her evaluations. She was opposed to the Vietnam War. She supported the civil rights movement. She technically passed the State Department exams, but she failed the final stress test because she expressed distaste for the South African policy of apartheid, which did not sit well with the people that were in charge. And so she kind of spun out at that point. So that didn't end up really working out for her, unfortunately. But while she was taking one of her graduate courses in primitive art at Columbia University, she saw an ad in the New York Times that was offering training for someone to become an assistant film editor. So she responded to the advertisement. She got the job. And basically, it was a job that was just randomly cutting frames from classic European films, like Jean-Luc Godard and Federico Fellini films, so that their length would conform to U.S. broadcast for television.
Right.
So basically, it was like, we need someone to come in with an eye and look at this really lengthy film and decide what can be omitted for U.S. television broadcasts. So she went ahead and did that, and then she really enjoyed it. And so she signed up for a brief 6-week course in filmmaking at NYU, which is where she met Mr. Scorsese. So he, at this time, was trying to finish up a film, What's a Nice Girl Like You Doing in a Place Like This? And his negative cutter, who had been working on it with him, had butchered it and did not leave enough negative frames to allow for hot splicing. So a film professor at NYU asked her, can you please help Marty? He's struggling. We need someone to step in. So she ended up helping him out. And they both, you know, enjoyed the process and it worked out okay. So she helped edit his first feature film, Who's That Knocking at My Door? And like, again, she wasn't in the union and it was kind of like a weird thing. Officially, she is credited as that being her first film with him. But like in an official capacity, like recognized by like in credits and everything like that, it's not the first time. So while she was at NYU, she also met filmmaker Michael Wadley. So then she, shortly after this, edited his very influential festival documentary, Woodstock, which Martin Scorsese also worked on as well. So this was her first like major thing, and it got her an Academy Award nomination for Best Editing.
Yes.
Which is kind of crazy. It was like her first like really big project, and already she was getting Academy recognition.
Well, and it's amazing for like a documentary to be nominated for editing.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Some of the things that were noted from this were her uses of superimpositions and freeze frames, which kind of brought the performances up to life because it is a music festival.
Right.
And also kind of like made it more viable to larger audiences. Like people felt more, it was more of like a combo of a music video that was educational rather than a documentary in the sense that had existed before. And she also like is beloved by the people she works with because she does absolutely everything. She is so hands-on. She screens and catalogs each day's footage. She even all the way to the end process of when they're doing foreign film market translations, she oversees that to make sure. She said, she said she took this on after seeing Woodstock at Cannes because according to the French subtitles, Sly and the Family Stone were singing, quote, I've got to have a Honda, not I want to take you higher.
Oh, my.
Like, according to the translation. Right. So she now is very all about all the final edits. Anything is part of her job.
Wow. Good for her.
So once this was done, despite having been nominated for an Oscar, she couldn't work on feature films unless she became a member of the Motion Picture Editors Guild.
Right.
Which this was a major problem for her in the like late 70s, early 80s. The union's entry requirements included spending 5 years as an apprentice and 3 as an assistant, which she was just unwilling to do.
Yeah, right.
She said about it, quote, I just couldn't see why I, who had been a full editor and had been nominated for an Academy Award, should suddenly have to become an apprentice. And of course, they couldn't see the sense why I, who had never been in the union all those years and had never paid dues all those years and had never served my time in their sense, should be allowed as a full editor. So it was quite understandable on both sides. It was just insane.
Yeah.
So.
Boy.
Because she was not able to join the union at the time, she has denied working with Scorsese during this time, but of course he did repeatedly call her asking for her help, for her services, and instead she started cutting documentaries for a WQED in Pittsburgh. She also did a short film for Paul McCartney on his world tour.
Oh, wow.
And she served as a special consultant on The Kids Are All Right, which was a documentary about The Who. During which Martin Scorsese was working on, so they reunited in a like working capacity again. And everything is unclear about what happened here. But somehow, between him, between Robert De Niro, it's everybody has a different story about how it happened. But somebody managed to get her into the editing union during this time.
Huh.
We don't really know. People think that, you know, somebody sweet-talked somebody, somebody smoothed things over, massaged the situation, whatever. But she was admitted to it without her petitioning or having to do her own thing. So she's miraculously accepted into the union, which is a very silly thing because, you know, she should have been for her work
from
already.
The beginning.
And a part of this too is she did make like uncredited contributions to Taxi Driver and that kind of thing during this time, but, you know, couldn't really officially in any capacity have her name on it and stuff. And part of the funny thing about Taxi Driver specifically was that for some reason, I didn't really look into it too much. Maybe you talked about it already. I don't know. Martin Scorsese had decided not to edit the picture during principal photography, and he had saved all the editing until shooting had wrapped, which unfortunately left him with very little time to cut the picture and edit it because their contract for Columbia said that it had to be supplied in the middle of February. Mm. So he brought her in, like, mm-hmm. as an emergency, like, please, I need someone to help me get this done.
Yeah.
So finally, in the 80s, she's admitted to the union. Hooray. And they officially collaborate on Raging Bull.
Great.
Which gets her an Academy Award for Best Film Editing, which mm-hmm. is amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, like, the two main pictures she has actually worked on, one got her her nomination and the second got her a win. Crazy. She said about this quote, "The first time I worked with Scorsese, we were doing Raging Bull with De Niro, and he kept asking for more takes of each scene until he got it right, which is typical for actors. But Marty would do about 10 takes, and then he would say, that's it. And Bob would say, six, we've got six good ones. And Marty would say, you can use some of those later if you want, but we're going on now. And that's when you learned you could get too much of a good thing." Mm. And of course, everybody praises her for her editing on Raging Bull. This is from Far Out magazine, quote, "When we consider the iconic fight scene in Raging Bull, we praise Robert De Niro's acting and Martin Scorsese's direction, but never Thelma Schoonmaker's editing," which I don't think is necessarily true. I think that, you know, we now know how essential she is.
The Editors Guild considers it the best edited film of all time. I would think that she has some...
And she won the award. And right.
They did. I mean, De Niro did. But yeah. Martin Scorsese could not beat first-time director Robert Redford. I will say that it is noticeably very well edited. Like, as a person who's as into editing, like, and that's one of the things I don't necessarily understand as much about film and filmmaking and, like, how it all fits together. Mm-hmm. It is pretty amazing to think about the shots and how they all were and how somebody had to compile them.
Yeah.
And like,
well, and the whole point of it is that you don't notice it. If you notice it, then something's wrong. But if
but you notice this film in a good way, which is pretty amazing, I think.
Yeah. I feel like in films that have very high quality editing, my first instinct is to attribute it to the director and be like, wow, they had a vision, like this, like fast paced, like super cut that is, everything is meaningful, blah, 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 blah. And it's like, that is true. Obviously, the director has the vision for those things, but it's executed by your editor.
Well, and when you watch it, it just feels so different of a film because there's so much slow motion and there's so much non-talking footage and there's so much like screenshots and it's just a very atypical film that nowadays feels very like artsy in a way. But the way that it all fits together is very, I mean, it is very documentary-ish. Like, it feels in that style because it's so atypical from a typical feature. And it's just, like, amazing that she was able to fit it all together the way that she did.
Yeah. Well, and there's so much cunning that goes into, like, what to land on and what to cut away quick from and when to hold the tension. And I didn't pull this quote, but she talked about when she worked on The Wolf of Wall Street, on the scene where Leonardo DiCaprio's on the boat and the other guy walks away leaving him there and it's like, it's gone wrong or whatever. And Martin Scorsese was like, okay, great, cut away from it. And she's like, no, like, I know it's weird and it doesn't fit, but this is, we need to hold this moment longer. We need to like let it be longer than feels comfortable. We need to let this like silence hold because the movie has no other like quiet, lengthy moments. And it's so uncomfortable and it's so effective. And like those little things where it's like just the tiniest change of pacing or whatever can really draw attention to a moment that otherwise no one paid attention to. I mean, and I'm just explaining what it is to edit a film, but it's like remarkable.
Yeah.
I wanted to share some of these quotes from her interview with Nick Pinkerton, which is her most famous interview. It's like if you ever hear a quote from her, it's from this interview. So I figure I may as well share some of the more popular ones. But this is from her quote. There's a great deal of mystery in film editing, and that's because you're not supposed to see a lot of it. You're supposed to feel that a film has pace and rhythm and drama, and you're not necessarily supposed to be worried about how that was accomplished. And because there's so little understanding about what really great editing is, like we've been talking about, a film that's flashy, that has a lot of quick cuts and explosions, gets particular attention. For example, with The Aviator, which I won an Oscar for, I'm sure that decision was based largely on the very elaborate plane crash that Howard Hughes had. That's so dramatic, and you can really see the editing there. But for me, and for a lot of editors and directors, the most interesting editing is not so visible. It's the decisions that go into building a character or a performance, for example, or how you rearrange scenes in a movie if it's not working properly so that you can get a better dramatic build. And, of course, they continue to talk about just, like, the problems that come up, the style that comes up. And she said, quote, "The priority is absolutely on the best take for performance. And, frankly, I don't understand why people get so hung up on these issues. Because if you look at films throughout history, you will see enormous continuity errors everywhere, particularly when you're talking about the Academy aspect ratio, where you see more in the frame. Even in The Red Shoes," which her husband actually made, but I didn't get to talk about that, "a film that nobody ever has complaints about, there are enormous continuity bumps, and it doesn't matter. You know why? Because you're being carried along by the power of the film. So throughout our history of improvisational cutting, we have decided to go with the performance, or in this case, particularly with the humor of a line, as opposed to trying to make sure a coffee cup is in the right place."
Right.
Which, brilliant. I mean, that's what makes you a good editor. And of course, like, I feel like that is also a part of being good storytellers, where, like, you are both focused on what serves the story, even if it is outside of, like, what you expected.
Yeah. Well, and it takes such a trained professional eye to then help craft that, too.
Yeah.
And, like, follow, like she's saying, all the through lines of finding the right performance and following the acting and following the character arcs and making sure that, like, every moment is telling the right story.
Yeah.
Yeah. So impressive.
For sure. So that's kind of what I wanted to just share about her today. I really just wanted to praise her and, like, her contributions. I mean, she's still going, so, like,
I know
it's not
crazy.
The end or anything. And, like, she's a private person in a lot of ways. And so, like, there isn't a lot of other stuff to share about her personal life. I mean, she married Michael Powell, who she met through Martin Scorsese. He, you know, was a director and, of course, did many classics throughout time, and they were together until he died, and they didn't have any children. Like, I mean, she's just a very simple woman, who is just really good at her job.
It's also so different when you work, like, more behind the scenes in film, and you're not, like, a celebrity actor. You don't tend to have many, like, I don't know, wild stories or
the other thing
foibles
I was,
that you go through.
Yeah, the other thing I was thinking is, like, how funny it is to have someone who is, like, so essential in the film industry, and no one's, like, looking to her to make a political statement or do anything. Nobody cares what she thinks about anything, ultimately.
Right.
And it just reinforces to me how silly it is that, like, we force that on other public figures.
Yeah, actors and directors.
Yeah.
And writers.
And, like, let your art speak for itself. Obviously, she's made a lot of
amazing statements
through her art.
Yeah, right.
And her perspectives on things and her collaborations. Duh. But anyways, I just wanted to mention some of, I don't want to go through her whole filmography, but, like, a lot of her hits, the best of, I guess. Of course, there's Raging Bull, The Color of Money. She did the Bad music video for Michael Jackson.
Yeah, which Scorsese directed.
Yes, yeah, together, of course. The Last Temptation of Christ, Goodfellas, The Age of Innocence, Gangs of New York, The Aviator, The Departed, Shutter Island, Hugo, The Wolf of Wall Street, Silence, which I love and everybody slept on, but I love that story. The Irishman, and of course, coming out this year, Killers of the Flower Moon. I mean, she's a busy lady.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's what I have to share today.
Amazing.
So.
And we will talk about her again in the future when she wins more awards.
Yeah. I felt like this was a good time to talk because I didn't have anything else I felt super inspired to talk about. And it's her first win. Mm-hmm. So may as well, you know,
well,
throw it out there.
Congrats to her.
Yeah.
And future congrats on the way.
Woohoo.
And with that, we come to the end of our episode, in which we like to thank the Academy for things relating to this episode, the people we discuss, the films that we talk about. What would you like to thank the Academy for today, Kristen?
First, I would like to thank the Academy for incredible makeup and hairstylists.
Yeah.
Obviously, the Elephant Man is the breaking point, but there are so many other great examples of this and incredible prosthetics that can make you look like a creature or mm-hmm. an ape or whatever. And it's amazing to see how these things happen. There's so much creativity and artistry that goes into that.
Even back to like the very first films that we talked about on the podcast, when the trend was like aging a character yeah. through like
the life
60
of Emile
years
Zola.
Of their life, which was very common. Like some of those makeup effects yeah. are just incredible.
Yeah. And
it's
hard
a shame
to clock.
That those were not like awarded back in the day, yeah. but luckily we have history to, you know, share those people's names
yeah.
and carry their legacies
part
on.
Part of why we have this podcast is to highlight yeah. those things as we go along that may not have been highlighted in the moment.
But it's nice that even today, in a like a world of CGI and craziness where that is concerned, there's still a lot of films and filmmakers who are focused on doing practical like mm-hmm. makeup and prosthetics, and I don't know, it's such an essential part of the industry.
Yeah, well, and I feel like since CGI has, you know, popped off so much, it's gotten kind of boring mm-hmm. and I think there's a little bit of a return to practical stuff now, which yeah. I think is good. I definitely prefer that. That's why Lord of the Rings looks so amazing. It will never
I know,
age,
right?
Because it's all real.
It's all real.
It's tangible.
Well, and one movie too to shout out in that vein is the new Guardians of the Galaxy Volume
yeah.
3. I mean, there is a lot of really incredible CGI, like yeah. some of the best I've seen in a long time. But there's also some really, really amazing practical makeup and effects too.
Yeah,
that are going to be. Hopefully going to be acknowledged.
Yeah, hopefully we'll be talking about it.
That'd be really great. Yeah, they deserve it. I would like to give a thanks to family acting legacies. We talk about them fairly often. There's so many family acting legacies throughout time. But this is the first dog family that we've discussed with multiple generations of actors.
Oh,
how fun.
How fun. We love nepotism and we hate nepotism.
It's what makes the Hollywood world go round. Without it, there would be no Hollywood.
That's true. There would be no Barrymores.
That's true.
I would like to thank the Academy for... And of course, I mean, this is multifaceted, but I would like to thank the Academy for the people who do the unseen or unappreciated work that make movies mm-hmm. essential, like film editors, like Thelma. You know, we don't always think of those things right away, but there are so many elements of filmmaking that, I don't know, I've just grown to appreciate so much. You can't have a good movie if it's badly edited. We've been watching, this is like a little bit of a tangent, but we've been watching TV lately that's so badly edited.
Yeah.
Like Zach and I have been sitting watching, we're like, what? That cut was so bad. Why did it linger so long? Or like, why did they cut so fast? I didn't see her reaction. Or like, and not in a like positive way, like a yeah. creative way, in a messy, convoluted way. And we're like, duh. Did no one take a second pass at this or something?
Yeah.
And you can just feel it. You feel it in the pacing. You feel it in the performances. You can kill an actor's performance, you know. And so when you have these people who are the unsung heroes, like Thelma,
mm-hmm.
it's incredible. So, yeah.
You can't say it enough that she's one of the main driving factors behind Martin Scorsese's success.
Yeah.
Of like the look and the feel and the pace, and like a lot of that is directing, but you know, at least 50% or more is editing as well.
Sure.
Because the editor can change so much of the film.
Yeah.
And of course they work hand in hand with the director and
right.
like
oversee the decisions. And
yeah.
whatever. But that is that creative spark comes from the editor.
Mm-hmm.
That vision and insight and clarity.
It's like three 50%, the writer, the director, and the editor.
All right.
The actors also contribute something.
Yeah, whatever.
I will give my final thanks for black and white film.
Ah.
It's so interesting to watch. I mean, we watch so many black and white films while doing this podcast. And it's been a while since I've seen a black and white film because we, you know, I'm not always watching old films that are black and white.
Yeah.
And especially now that we're moving into this era for the podcast and watching these films, it's just like, it felt refreshing in a way to watch a black and white, two black and white films. And just like, I don't know. And it's also nice that like they had the choice to make them in black and white for like artistic purposes. And it makes it so much more interesting, I think. Mm-hmm. Both of these films are better for them being black and white.
Yeah, that's cool.
Which is nice. I don't know.
Yeah.
And they're both shot in such nice ways. Like the cinematographers, obviously, are both amazing cinematographers that both got nominated. But like, they're just really lovely to see and look at. They're very, very well lit, of course. And then, of course, the editing on top of all of that just makes them both visually like very stunning films.
Yeah, another unsung hero, the lighting. Yeah. Oh my gosh. You want to make a person look terrible, you light them badly. Oh. Yeah, that is one of my pet peeves.
Yeah. Well, and with that, we leave you.
Yes. Thank you for joining us.
Yes. Keep on joining us every now and then. We're very busy and have to take a week off or here and there, but thanks for sticking with us. We try to have a mostly regular schedule.
Yeah, whatever. Some of us are prepared. Sometimes I'm not prepared. It's true.
But then join us next time when we are discussing the 54th Academy Awards and the Best Picture winner, Chariots of Fire.
Thank you for tuning in to Thank the Academy. You can follow us on social media at Thank the Academy Podcast on Instagram and at Thank Academy Pod on Twitter. If you enjoy listening to the show, make sure to leave a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts and subscribe on your favorite streaming platform. The theme song was created by the one and only Noah Heisinger. Join us next week on Thank the Academy.